Welcome to the Grandson Podcast, otherwise known as Tim's Talks. Over the coming months, I'll be interviewing a number of people who we think you might find interesting. Today, I'm talking to the fascinating Scott Fraser Simpson, who launched his Scott Fraser collection 10 years ago and recently created a lovely loaf with us. Scott talks about growing up in Hong Kong, his early years as a mod, and in particular, how he started his business. We hope you enjoy it.
Scott, welcome.
Hello, Tim.
How are you?
I'm great, thank you.
Good, good.
We're getting the last of last bits of sunshine coming through London, which is beautiful.
A bit of context, yeah, because it was coming here today. It was really warm.
It's beautiful. I sat in Soho Square just there for about half an hour watching the ping pong players and
But the rest. But for us, I don't know about for you, but for us, being that warm at the end of September is not good because we want people to change, we want the weather to change, so we get into boots and winter stuff.
Naturally, I will hold on to summer for as long as possible there, if I can.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, it's the state of the environment is sort of a deeper question, but the idea that it could be sunnier for longer, I'm like, oh, yes, give it to me.
Right. Yeah,
for the longer. But no, as a in terms of like, creating kind of clothing and shoes and products, it's it's the change back to school kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. Back to school.
Yeah, they say this sort of thing. Yeah,
great. Well, thank you very much for coming along.
No problem.
Obviously, we put together this chew together. We've known each other for quite a long time, but the first time we've kind of worked together as two businesses and people, what have you. So we thought it would just be great to have a chat about, let some of our followers know a bit more about you, bit your background and your ideas and thoughts and what have you, and then maybe talk a bit about the shoe later so people get a bit of background.
Yeah, that's fine.
So can I take you, I know it's boring because you've done this before and, you know, it's nothing new, but can I take you right back to the beginning and tell us where were you born?
I love talking about myself. No, it's fine. You know, it's important to set the scene, you know.
So whereabouts, where were you born and where were you brought up?
I was born in Hong Kong. My parents had also been there my dad had grown up there since he was five. And he'd lived in Pakistan beforehand. And my mum had moved over there when she was 17. She'd sort of left home, not great parents, that kind of thing, and moved out, fled to Hong Kong.
Where did they meet in Hong Kong?
And they met in Hong Kong. You know, she was a little bit younger, but, you know, he'd grown up there. My grandparents were part of kind of like a education kind of roles and things. So anyway, from there, they'd sort of lived there all that time. Then had me and my brothers and sisters. And then I moved to England when I was about 14, 15.
Oh, okay.
And from there, but we always had a connection in Brighton. So we would come back in the summers. My grandparents then had left Hong Kong and moved to Brighton. And we'd come back to Brighton and sort of spend the summer holidays on the beach and swimming and that kind of thing.
So do you remember, how much do you remember about Hong Kong? Because I was just wondering about, because of what you do, I wonder if there was any influence from that whole Hong Kong tailoring scene and everything. Do you remember much about kind of Hong Kong and what influence it had on you fashion-wise?
Totally, absolutely.
Culture-wise, generally?
Constantly. I am influenced by it. You know, I kind of hark back to things. But, you know, my dad, my parents were both influential on me. My dad, in particular, used to take me. We're very similar. Like, I was professing my, you know, undying love for him on the weekend over a few drinks and telling him how similar we are and all of this, and we were agreeing. But he used to take me for himself. He used to sort of bring us along to all the little back street tailors in Hong Kong. And growing up there from 1955, he knew everything about Hong Kong. He could speak Cantonese. He could. He knew all the places to go and get, you know, X, Y, and Z. And like, only this weekend I was wearing a shirt that he had made in 1967, which I found in a garage a couple of months ago in his house.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
What kind of stuff would he wear?
He was he calls him like himself, you know, that kind of kinks, dedicated follower of fashion. He was that kind of, born in 1950. you know, by sort of the late 60s, he's coming into his sort of like, you know, strong teens, 16, 17, 18. So he's sort of swinging 60s with a touch of kind of Hong Kong influence, had been living in England and that kind of thing. So, you know, he was a real dresser. He had his own looks. He was always talking about, you know, different types of paisleys he'd have. He'd have kind of silk shirts made with his name embroidered and pockets. And anyway, he used to take us a lot to these tailoring shops where we would sort of sit around in these over air conditioned, kind of like well lit rooms full of fabric on these little slithers. And that was just what we were doing. And I remember kind of him talking to the tailors or whoever was there and just creating this stuff, sketching stuff out, you know, he'd always sketch and finding it quite interesting that you could just do that with people. And like suddenly, you know, you'd go back 2 weeks later or whatever it was and you have stuff made for you. So I think that was a really seminal part of my...
Was it very different from Savile Row? I mean, I've never seen it.
Hugely.
I mean, it sounds amazing. More accessible.
Way more accessible. Savile Row, my God, like, it's changed so much anyway, but it was that all the shops almost looked the same. You know, I didn't go to every single one, you know, but he took me to the ones that he liked, but, you know, they weren't exceptionally well fitted out. They were just very bright neon tubes with like fabrics, you know, from all far-flung corners of the world. And you know, just an overly friendly sort of sales guy or girl, I'm not really sure, you know, who was dealing with us. But essentially he would just sketch stuff out and there you'd go, like, we'd have stuff.
And do you remember any of the first kind of things that you commissioned or first bits of clothing you had back then? I mean, you're still pretty young.
He would make for him.
Yeah.
But then there was a point where then I'd moved over to England and I decided I'd met a girl who's now my wife at school when I first moved here when I was 15.
In Brighton.
And I said to her, right, let's go back and let's meet my dad. My dad was still living in England. My parents had separated. We went back to see my dad. And on the way back, we went through Thailand to meet up with a couple of my friends. This was one, I think we were around 18. We'd like saved up and that was, we actually like spent a lot of our student loan on it to get back. But anyway, and we went back and on the way through to Thailand, I had brought a suit with me that I had just bought. And it was this sort of 80s Merc, very kind of mod revival kind of suit. And I went into a tailoring shop, just like my dad did. I thought, let me just go in and like see if they copy it. I ended up leaving the holiday about 8 days later with like 3 suits, 10 pairs of trousers, 8 shirts. I had some capes I even made. I was like going off at lunchtime to draw collars from like pictures.
Did you say capes?
Yeah, these sort of like...
Oh my.
Man, it was so...
Wow, that's
so
great.
Hard. It wasn't like long capes. There were these... it was based off these pictures. It's very deep dive. Of Hardy Amy's of Savile Row.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That I was really into at that very moment. And it was these sort of dinner suit capes. They were kind of cropped. They go down just below your shoulder. You kind of wear them in the same fabrics as like the suit would be made in. So it was a kind of three-piece suit, you know, that you could get made. But
it was a kind of thing when it was raining, I guess.
It was sort of very tailored and cut away. But it was something that I was like really proud that I'd like made this. And it had slip pockets you could put your hands through. And I just studied the pictures and much like... how I think I continue to do a lot of my work now, I realized that was like where I was having the most fun I could. I would leave the pool, I'd leave my friends and I'd be like, well, I'm just going off to draw this thing with the guys at the shop. And I loved it. And that was where I realized, oh yeah, that's what I used to do with my dad and also just like be around it. And then you could create and how amazing it was that you.
So,
you
know. So also a connection with your dad.
Yeah. Like 100%.
A nostalgic thing about.
100%.
Yeah, like remembering being with him.
Remembering being with him, but also just remembering like just the buzz of being able to create something that you kind of wanted or you felt like you couldn't get, or you didn't even know where to get it or afford it. Because a lot of the time, you know, by making in these places, it wasn't actually more as expensive as what my dad was explaining, it wasn't as expensive as going and buying something at, let's say, your, you know, like local shopping center and
from a big brand.
Yeah, you know, you could go and have your own, you know, big pockets and your name put on it, and it's cheaper than the sort of counterpart that you could get from a brand. And I was really excited by that.
I mean, the reason I'm interested in all this is just visiting your store. We'll come back to your store in a minute, but just the connection. I can see a connection between, you know, that kind of personal service, but also the thing about getting something unique. And that, can you remember feeling that you would, if you go to a department store or you go to a shopping mall or whatever, everybody can buy the same stuff, but you go to a tailor and you come out with something that you've really designed yourself in a way, and it's unique and nobody else has that thing. Do you remember that kind of feeling?
That moment, I think I was speaking about with the in Thailand where I had gone, I really was amazed at the variation that I was able to get, you know.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh my God, like, where's the limit? You know, you know, there was a limit of what I knew I could want, what I wanted. But I went from 6 buttons on my jacket to then 5 to then like a little ticket pocket, or then a little button on the bottom of my trousers to, and it was just, it was sort of overwhelming, yet kind of like just, I wanted to dive straight in, you know, and do it and continue to do it. And I sort of struggled with that idea, not struggled, but I sort of tussled with the idea of, oh, you know, I probably should go and get a job in, you know, something else, because I went to do creative advertising at university. That's what I'd been studying in London when I moved up to London.
Yeah.
And it was always kind of going in that kind of advertising route, you know, creative advertising of sorts. And there was always something that kind of held me back. You know, I'd always try and turn my hand to selling a bit of vintage clothing or working at this shop a bit more that was selling clothes. And and from there, I think I realized, that's maybe why I'm sort of stunting it a little bit, because that's truly what I wanted to do, but didn't really know how, or wasn't educated in it, you know, and that was the other thing.
So when you first came to the UK, you went straight to Brighton.
Yeah, straight to Brighton.
Did you do you remember noticing a difference in the way people dressed or the fashion or anything? Did you bring with you your kind of influences by that stage and then just carry on, or did you get to Brighton and see a whole different kind of scene? And
over in the summer, I think I was aware that there was a difference. You know, there was the sort of townies and there was the this and the, you know, there was some bits that were kind of like, you go, oh right, I don't know that, but I felt like I picked up on it, because I always am kind of like, my eyes are always like scanning across, just sort of seeing what everyone's doing, what everyone's wearing, not in a sort of judgy way, but more than just like, oh, that's interesting, or oh, I wonder why they're doing that. But and I still am super curious. You'll kind of catch me walking down the street and I probably won't be listening to anything anyone says, but I'm just like, eyes everywhere.
Slightly inappropriately looking at people on the tube and stuff like that.
Yeah. But then smiling at them if they catch my eyes for too long, you know, not being that weirdo kind of look, just blankly looking. Yeah. But I did notice a difference when we came over here. I was kind of this skater, kind of surf skater boy, kind of came over sort of post Avril Lavigne's era. And I was sort of like that. And then I moved to Brighton. And naturally, I knew that there was this sort of mod culture.
I was going to say, that had all, Brighton, the mod scene.
And there was one shop, Jump the Gun, which is in Brighton, which is sort of in the lanes, which is quite, you know, iconic, if you know that sort of kind of thing. And I used to walk past it and was just, this is an interesting place. It always caught my eye, always was interesting. There was a scooter outside. My dad had also brought us up with classic, with old cars.
Yeah. So how did that old cars?
Old cars. He was just not into buying new stuff.
Yeah.
Everything was always like remade, or let's like, you know, restore this old thing. Yeah. And I mean, God, he had some amazing old cars, but you know, in Hong Kong back in the sort of early 90s, no one really wanted these sort of 60s British sports cars. They were sort of tatty and old, and he loved them. Mm. And we used to have a little, when we moved to England, we had this Morris Traveller, which was this sort of wooden sided
Yeah,
that was my first car actually.
Morris Minor.
Minor, but with the traveller back, yeah. So the back doors
those
opened.
Those beautiful
out.
Back doors, gorgeous, like wooden.
Yeah, I had an idea once of putting a rail across the two back doors and then having clothes dangling from there. And you could pitch up anywhere and sell clothes and stuff like that. But I never quite got to do it. I had to sell the car eventually. But he brought us up with that. So naturally, anything old, I was curious. I'd go to antique shops growing up, you know, continuously too. That would be my other place, you know. Yeah. Incense burning in the corner and stuff in Hong Kong, but being here, there was that mod scene, or there was that kind of whole thing, and I was just interested. So I used to just sometimes just go into the shop and just start chatting, you know, as a sort of 15, 16 year old, kind of what's this all about, and you know, and thankfully there was nice guys in there that used to just talk at me for an hour to an hour and a half, telling me what was what, and what
were they dyed in the wool mods?
Pardon me?
Were they kind of, in particular in Jump the Gun, they were like proper mods?
They were 80s revival. Now, you know, they were sort of revival mods, but they were, you know, they were quite deep in the scene and you know, they knew what they were doing. Yeah. A lot
like
of the
Paul
kind of,
Weller and all that.
Yeah,
kind of
exactly. The Secret Affair and all of that sort of stuff. You know, Two Secret Affair. All of that. And I really, that was kind of where I got into it, but quite quickly kind of fell, my fascination with all of that went much earlier, almost back to the roots of it. But I was that's how I came in, you know, through that madness and you know, two-tone and
Selector.
Oh my gosh, yeah, you know, all of that, you know, love it.
So did you become, I mean, I always think with the mod thing, you, there are some people that just kind of like the look a little bit and wear a bit of the, you know, the two-tone suit or whatever, the tonic
stuff.
But you can also get fully immersed, can't you, where your whole life becomes
that was
did
me.
You get into
that
you
was
did
me.
Go for that
100% I you know, from 16 you can't kind of financially kind of go as deep as you'd like, but musically I tried to learn as much as I could. I used to get sort of Trojan reggae dub sound, sort of to dancehall reggae to this, you know, box sets from friends' cars and nick them out of there and listen to them and then give them back. And I'd go to Jump the Gun and I'd buy bits, or go to this vintage shop which was called Dead Men's Closet, and well, it wasn't called that, but they used to call it that, and you know, buy my first little donkey jacket and sheepskin coat and all of this, and just piece it together. But what was the most amazing part of it was growing up there was then I got a scooter when I was 16. I saved up. I worked at a little sushi restaurant down there, and I saved up and I bought an 80s Vespa, 50cc, and I had that, and I joined a scooter club. And from there, these guys took me under their wing as like a little protege, you know, and they used to take me out to little soul dudes, and we'd go on ride outs, and they taught me how to you know, build bikes and what to do with bikes when they went wrong. And that's where I learned a lot about like just the culture behind it. And there was a tribe already made, and you know, there's people doing it, and they're dancing in this way. I managed to get in at sort of 17 to little soul clubs on the seafront and watch them sort of flap their arms around and do spins, and what is this? This is unreal. And then I moved to London when I was 17. I left Brighton early, moved up to London on my own, and there was a whole scene there, but deeper in the music, you know. It wasn't as scooter based, but there was everything here.
And fashion wise, was it were you learning as well from them about what you're allowed to, because it's quite
there are confines, and I mean, you know, fast forward, it was almost like too much, but it was also it's like a blessing and a curse, I think, because in one way you learn the depths of and the foundations of things and where they come from, and actually I'm quite inquisitive about that, you know, why is there a tassel? Why is there this on a jacket? Why is there that? And then you'd also have people that you could butt up against. I had a crew of friends, about 10 of us, that would like play off each other, you know, oh, what are you wearing? And like, take this down to the tailors and work with this tailor, to, like an alteration shop, and get them to change some vintage piece that we'd just managed to get, or we were all into something. We all had our little, you know, our little go-to. I had knitwear and some of us had suits, some others had whatever, but...
Yeah, shirts was always a big thing.
Yeah, you know, the button-down with the three, you know, three-finger sort of...
Yes, exactly.
All that. And I think I learned a lot. And I learned from different eras of people that had been through it. So I felt like I really amassed a lot of what that scene was about, and also kind of like retrospective kind of subcultures, which is a huge interest of mine anyway, you know, musically, but also just like what comes with the fashion and stuff.
Did you like, I mean, a lot of those people love the idea, it's not just the clothing and stuff, but they like the idea of belonging to a kind of movement.
Yeah.
Or is that something that eventually you kind of say, actually, I don't want to be labelled as that. I want to move on and what have you.
That's sort of, I was deep into it for years. I was record collecting. I was DJing at clubs. We were all going to this, you know, clubs like three or four times a week. There was 100 club. There were on, you know, Oxford Street just up there. I DJed there at the Soul Night of there and went to Italy to play. And, you know, after a while, I think it just started to feel, especially with clothes, it started to feel like if you were to break a rule or something, or if you would break those kind of unwritten codes, you would start to be kind of like, okay.
Yeah.
And that I am naturally quite rebellious in my nature.
Yeah.
Although I like to kind of like, I conformed with all of that. To a point, there was something in me that was like, nah, I ain't going to be told by you, I shouldn't be wearing this, or I shouldn't have my trousers that wide or whatever, you know, and that was a real turning point, is when I said, nah, I'm going to have
big I'm not going to get the ruler out.
No, I'm not going to have a 7.5-inch bottom anymore. No. It's going to be a 10, you know, and go swivel on that. And then that was where it really truly kind of like changed my perspective. But, you know, I'm blessed for being able to, I feel, come up through that, because subculturally I didn't feel like there was much else available, and I was very much like, this is great, you know.
Yeah.
And the thing about it that I always loved is that, you know, the music, although it was old, there was people always digging records, and records that had never probably even been heard since the day that they've been pressed, you know, in the States or wherever, the back, you know, the back end and beyond. Well,
the whole Northern Soul thing.
Exactly. Like, and it just... Exactly, and I think I saw a post that you did the other just recently, you guys had done. And I think that whole kind of spirit still lived in it, which made it very contemporary in its own way. Even though it was old, it didn't mean that it was just playing the same old shit all the time. Mm. It was just sort of like, oh, there's this new tune that we're all listening to. And it had cycles, and it had sort of trends, and it had like undulations in it. And that's what I found quite interesting, that it was actually... It didn't actually matter that it was that old. It was actually more just about this, who was into it, you know.
And do you think that, you know, that thing that is very, very British, which is about fashion that comes up through a street culture thing, whether it be punk, mods, even skinheads, you know, and it's tied to a group of people, it's tied to the fashion, the music, where they go, what they do. It's a whole cultural thing. Do you think that will ever come back? Because nowadays, there's none of that, really, is
there?
There's no punk movement.
There isn't. I think online allows people to have those moments, but they are... I think it's quite fractious. But I don't think it's a bad thing. I think there's so many different sides to it, but as a sort of wave of society that is into one thing, I don't think... There are, but they're much more kind of... normie and not so exciting, or not as exciting for me to sort of be interested in. I am still very interested in turning on you know, Love Island or watching Kardec, but I don't do it for more than 10 seconds to go, all right, that's what people are wearing. There's a big crew of people like that, but but beyond that, I think, you know, I think online and Instagram and you know, all the platforms, they give people a place to be into something, and that's what I think has been great. And you can create a community even if you aren't around. And I feel like that's partly something I probably owe a lot of my success or kind of just like customer base too, is actually being able to say, hey, you know, you're not in the same place as me. We may not even be, you know, wearing, listening to the same music or whatever, but we're, you're able to sort of vibe together in some way or another. because you can share similar things. Or
yeah.
So I think, yeah, there's sort of a two side to it.
You're very much into research, aren't you? And you everything you kind of get into, you know a lot about. And I can see that coming through your store and through your clothing, that it's not just about something that you think looks nice. It's got a history to it and a story behind it.
Yeah.
Is that must be important going forward?
I think it's important. I think it's really important for me. It's important to just try to learn a little bit about it. I think it's sort of it's been something for me about like sort of a respect for what has come before. You know, if you're going to go and mess with it a bit, or you're going to try to sort of play with it, you kind of want to go, well, why did they do that, or what was the reason? And for me, I think I always like to learn. I'm always just hungry to learn about things, and I'll never know. I always think I'll never know enough about anything. Mm. I'll try to understand it, but I'll never be like, you know, I'm not going to be stand there and be the authority on it. But I do, I love it. I love going down wormholes. You know, it passes time when I'm like stuck on a train in someone's armpit going back, you know, back home. Mm. I'm kind of deep in something about something. But, you know, it's good. And I think passing that on, that information on, is important.
So tell us how... So you've Brighton, you've come to London.
Yeah.
How did you really start to get into what you do now? And what were the steps, and how have you got to where you are now?
So I've been running Scott Fraser Collection for the last... It was actually 10 years in the middle of August.
It's your anniversary.
A decade, they say. Yeah, a decade.
I don't remember the party.
I haven't had a party, and I feel really kind of like... I love a party, you know. I make my birthday last about 2 months.
Ten years, it's a big party.
It's a big deal. Yeah. I think I'm a bit overwhelmed by the idea of it. And also, it's been 10 years, but it's not been... You know, it's not been full time. You know, I started it. Mm. I was working. It's mad. I was working at a shop on Brick Lane, so right on the east end, just round the corner from where I've got a shop now. You know, And I started working there on the weekends whilst I was at university, and doing sort of Sundays, and then the odd Monday when I had free time. And built his website. He was a bit old school, sort of a market trader, Leroy. He'd been there for years and years and years selling stuff, but he got me into a lot of kind of knitwear and. Sort of, you know, Jamaican culture, kind of knitwear, all sorts of stuff. Sort of him growing up in London in the 80s, all of this. Anyway, I got really deep into it and helped him build the side of his business. And I sort of also then realized, well, hey, look, if I'm building him a website and I'm watching him make clothes and do his own thing, I think I could give it a go myself and maybe make something for myself and see what happens. So I made a bag. And I made a duffel bag, and I left. I went to get a bagel for lunch, and I on Brick Lane, and I went into just sort of leather workshop and said, hey, what do I need if I want to make a bag? And it went off like that, and it was, you need this, you need that, you need a pattern, all right, okay, and I sort of just went with it.
And where did you sell it then?
I built myself a website. I had still the crew of people that I knew from the mod scene, you know, and that was quite a large scene of people of all ages.
Yeah.
And people would buy bits. And then I was like, right, I'm going to make myself a shirt and see what happens. And it was sort of, you know,
amazing.
Just a couple of different fabrics. I found them in the local store, made them to order. And that was it, really. And that started me. I was kind of like, well, I don't have any money to start it properly. I don't, you know, I can, you know, I'm getting my work from the various different places. Why don't I just make to order and make people wait 3 weeks? Yeah. I think it was even 2 weeks back then.
Yeah.
I yearn for 2 weeks. but I just started it like that. Yeah. And an order would come in. I'd drop the fabric off on my little scooter. I'd be able to go to drive to that fabric shop, pick that fabric up. I didn't even have to buy the fabric sometimes.
Mm.
And I'd just go and pick up 1.5 meters, take it back to the place just around the corner.
Yeah.
This woman called Susan who used to make my stuff. And from there, it just grew. And a new collection got dropped in. Another collection of things, you know, tried that.
You were actually putting a collection together by that, not just like individual pieces.
A collection, no. What I mean by collection really is, I think, a collection of shirts. You know, a drop of one thing.
Yeah.
The idea of doing one mammoth, you know, autumn, winter, spring, summer, kind of, I didn't know what to do.
No.
You know, I hadn't like studied fashion, gone to fashion school, but I didn't feel... I never really felt like I needed to, because I felt like if I needed to know anything, I never got, I never like came up against something and I thought, oh God, like, oh, I don't know. Because I'd always just say, oh, can you explain that? Or try and understand what they were talking about, you know? And they'd tell me what I needed to know. And I'd try and go away and read it and try and understand. So it's grown very organically. And it's grown, you know, with all different types of people that have kind of got involved with it, got really interested in it. And
until,
and,
I guess, the shop. I mean, the shop, yeah. Doing a shop is a big step, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a sort of shop come studio. So it still doesn't have... Yeah. It still doesn't have the kind of like you can come every single day. No. But what it's got is like a hub.
God forbid,
for people.
You don't want people just turning up.
God, no. It happens every day. No, I mean, it'd be quite a lot. And because we make to order, it's quite, and still do, it's quite, for me, it's quite important that the story is correct and that kind of like customer service and that kind of like ability to talk it through and the fit and hey, we can change this for you. Because what I found by doing that was, that guy's 5'4" and this guy's 6'6" and that shirt's not going to fit him in the same way as that other guy. And why don't we just chop it shorter or make it longer? And because we're making to order, it doesn't, it's one line on a piece of paper for me. And for, and that's what I really still love doing. But it's like just tweaking things for people. When it's very simple, or when, you know, a very simple thing.
So kind of semi-bespoke.
Semi-bespoke, but without it needing to be that kind of like, you know, that bit more expensive for people to go, oh God, I can't, a bit worried that it's going to like impact me for being, you know, extremely tall or short or whatever, or whatever it is, you know. And I like doing it. I like being able to sort of flex that kind of...
But you, is that how you see it in the future? I mean, could you see yourself having... maybe a studio three times the size, but that's it. But you're always there every day. And
I think,
or do you see yourself as Ralph Lauren in the future?
Oh, I think
3,000 stores around the world.
Yeah, I don't, personally, I don't think that's the way it will go, because I don't think I would be as excited by that. I think I still hold on to some fittings with people. I have other people that do fittings for me too, but I do love like sitting there and chatting with people or standing there or whatever, you know, going through the collection and kind of seeing their enthusiasm and kind of seeing what vibes off what they're wearing and I'm wearing and what they're bringing into it. You know, sometimes you get a real like feeling or like a thermometer of what's going on.
There must be part of that Hong Kong tailor thing that's part, still in your
psyche. Yeah, naturally.
It sounds like you're a modern version, modern of that.
No, it's funny. I think that's true. I think that's very much true. But I do enjoy it. I think the idea of it growing would be that there would be maybe outposts, you know, and we're much larger in the States. Sure. You know, we sell 70% out to the States.
Oh, really?
So with that, I think for us, it's about kind of setting ourselves up a little bit more over there. But but I think they still love the sort of London vibe. That, you know, they don't want me to move over to the States, I don't think. Or I don't think they want the brand to sort of change. But in that sense...
we'll see. We'll revisit this in a couple of years.
Yeah,
and see
you'll see
it in
my American accent.
Yeah. Let's go back to the store.
Yes.
What was it like? You had to find a store. You had to have some stock in there. You had to tell people about it. What advice would you give to people about starting their own business, particularly in retail like that?
I think I had a slow move into it. But I, for us, it was about just kind of testing the water. Oh, you know, putting out to your customer, you know, would you be interested in coming for fittings? And I actually, it's a mad story, but I set up a small rail in a vintage shop just around the corner. Actually, what am I talking about? It's in the basement of where we are now. Oh. It was a vintage shop before, and he let me have a rail, and I tested that out, and I had one rail with all of my trousers on, and people come down into this little dark basement and come for a fitting. I then left there because it flooded, and I thought, no, I need a space now. Set up another space around the corner, and after a few years of being there, it got too small, and then went to that very shop when he was leaving. And I think for me, it was about making sure I was always covered. I think, you know, starting with made to order was really important for me because I never wanted to over. I didn't have the ability to over. What's the word like?
Overexpose
myself.
Yeah.
As a business, as a sort of. You know, young guy starting out in his thing, and also just like for my own kind of just feelings towards the brand. I didn't want to be like, oh no, they didn't want that, and I've been stuck with all this stock, you know.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
That was the thing. I just couldn't.
Yeah.
The idea of waste, the idea of also using fabrics in the best way possible. You know, a lot of the time the rolls that I'd be buying would be small and quite limited. Mm. And I was thinking, well, if I've got 4 smalls, 6 larges, and you know, and none of them sell.
Mm.
Well, you've wasted all that fabric. So for me, it's always been about making sure you don't overexpose yourself, and also kind of reaching out to your customer. Mm. And I think that's the thing, like, they are there. Mm. They are buying your stuff, and I've realized actually the power of going, hey, over to you, like, let me hear what you think, actually has been really valuable.
Mm.
Because quite often you just think, oh, I'll make moves as a business, because I think my customers will want it. And you should at times, because they don't want to, you to be like, tell me what to do next, you know. But quite a lot of the time I actually felt like, no, you can turn it to them, and they can feel spirited by the idea of, hey, yeah, let's go with it together, you know. And that was it. People were like, whoa, you got a shop, I'm coming, you know. And people are traveling, and people are traveling over for the day from like France and Sweden. It's crazy. I can't believe it sometimes. I'm quite shocked, but
yeah.
I'm blessed for it, but
I think that what you were saying about the kind of what's now become a sustainable way of doing business started out as an organic thing, which was very much, you know, what was happening before factories in the 19th century, which is everything was pretty much made to order.
Yeah.
Nowadays, with mass production and people make an enormous amount of stock to make sure that they don't run out when they're selling, but are left with tons of it at the end, which then goes on sale, and eventually some goes into landfill.
Yeah.
When you're making to order, you're just making what's required.
Exactly.
And it's more special, so people are buying pieces and keeping them for a long time, I guess.
And considering them, yeah.
Really
considering it.
Because they've got to wait for 3 months, and, you know, and they've got to, you know, or however long it is.
No, of course.
It's a real proper consideration.
So. It is a consideration. I think it's just important that we just check ourselves, you know, when we do that. I do, as we grow as a business, I do know that it's not that great sometimes to be waiting 4 or 5 weeks, you know, and people, oh, I'm going away. And that's where it gets me, you know. I'm like, okay, we'll try our best. But, you know, we've had to sort of take on some stock. But I think it's great if you can try to sort of find a balance.
Yeah.
Even today, I found this amazing, this is a side note, but like, I found this amazing brand that's doing fabrics, and you can choose two, you know, they're striped fabrics, that you can have them in all different types of material grades, and you can basically make to order exactly the color you want. The swatches are made to order, the 1 meter that you can order is made to order, and it's just unbelievable for interiors. And I'm just like, that, and it made in England, can't believe it. You know, I think that there's ability and acceptance from people now for all that, and it's quite nice, you know, that I haven't had to change it. I never really felt like I wanted to change it.
Great. Let's get on to shoes. Let's hear a little bit about your personal shoe history. What can you remember? What were the first kind of shoes that you fell in love with, and what have you kind of worn throughout the years?
I'm a self-confessed loafer head.
I have always been.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
I mean, really, since I started properly saying, hey, yeah, this is my clothes. I mean, I've had, you know, in my early teens, I was getting my own clothes from different places, but really come, you know, from sort of 15, 16, as I got into the mod scene, of course, the loafer was the thing that so I must have gone through, honestly, 100 loafers in my time.
Different kinds of loafers?
Generally, I'm quite kind of like variation. I collect variations of the same thing. So it's a sort of, penny loafer to a tasseled loafer to a, you know, low-vamped dress shoe to... But there's something about that shoe that I used to just think, yeah, no, I don't need. Why do I need any other shoes apart from maybe a trainer, literally to go running in? But like, other than that, like, I go to
the
beach in it.
Yeah, you can't really go running in a loafer. But,
well, you try me.
Yeah, give it a go.
No, but I used to go, you know, skate in a loafer, go to the beach in a loafer. I don't think I can think of anything else. My wife used to take the.
Unless it's a fisherman's sandal, of course.
Of course, and now I'm like opening and broadening my vocabulary of shoe. And I don't leave a fisherman's sandal in the summer, it seems. But
do you think the loafer thing? I always think, particularly with the whole mod culture, is the loafer works so well with A, the trousers that were shorter, and the socks and everything, and the whole, the three elements together, the bottom of the trousers, the sock, and the, was all part of the look.
It was, yeah, it kind of got pulled into it.
And a boot, you wouldn't see the sock,
no,
and so that would kind of change the whole look.
Yeah.
And even a shoe that was slightly higher cut, you wouldn't see so much, and it would be more about this bulky shoe.
It has a bit more of a formality to it, and I think, a shoe like that. But I think a loafer breaks it. You can wear it with all sorts of looks, you know, jeans to right up there with your sort of full suit. I just think it works, and I think, you know, once you get the right one and the right if they're comfortable, they feel like slippers. And I just knocked around in those for years and years and years, you know. I've never really, I like shoes, I like how they complete a look, but I'm not like I'm not a shoe obsessive, I'm obsessive of other.
You're
clothes.
A loafer obsessive.
I'm a loafer obsessive, and that's where I, you know, and that's where I felt really strongly when we started talking. It was that's just of course.
Do you not wear any lace-up shoes at all?
I do have lace-up shoes. I do have some, and I had some lovely like soft ones that I used to go dancing in, and you know they were nice for suits and things like that. You know, I'd be wearing a lot of suits a lot of the time. You know, my own sort of concoctions of them, but I just always came back to the loafer. Mm. It'd be like the thing that I'd wear, you know, my Oxblood loafers, that was it, you know, my penny, and I put my penny in, and I put my little 1 cent in. And
Would it have to be a 1 cent?
Yeah, I'd used to mess with like, you know, dual nationality sort of set up, you know, people, what the hell's that? Why is that? Yeah. And then you tell them the story about, you know, it's a, you know, luck and...
What was the original?
Well,
story
mine is for luck. My knowledge of it is for luck, having that penny in there. I've heard loads of different stories. If you're caught out, you can, you know, make a call with that. You know,
there used to be a thing about sailors going into town and knowing they were going to lose everything. They just want one coin to get back
lifeline.
To the boat.
I've heard that. I think also.
Don't know if it's true.
There's so many different variations, I'm sure, but. You know, there's a lot of like luck charms that go with kind of clothing, and especially, you know, back then.
Yeah.
And I'm always like fascinated by all of that. Really fascinated.
So when we first talked about doing a shoe together, was it instantly front of mind what the shoe was?
Yeah, 100%.
I mean, obviously a loafer, but it was exactly what loafer, what it was going to look like.
Yeah, pretty much. I think I knew of loafers around that were like, you know, your penny loafer, your this, and there was a box that had been ticked in my mind. It kind of crossed what was available, and I always felt like there was a space for this in my opinion that this kind of shoe. I had a couple of different options at the time that were tasseled. There was one in particular that was tasseled, but it had a lower vamp, so that lower front.
Describe it for people who haven't seen it, who are listening.
Well, I've got it in my bag.
Yeah,
I mean, get it the out. Listeners, really.
Yeah,
there you go.
See it, but there you go. Hello.
Here's one I prepared earlier.
Yeah,
and I've beaten the hell out of this.
Yeah,
And I just used to. I mean, a lot of people would just call it out on online and email about it and send pixelated screenshots of me wearing them, going, what is this shoe? What is this shoe? And I just, I knew that if there was going to be something that I was going to create, it would be something similar.
Mm. And the main feature for me as a kind of shoe designer is for people listening, is that the front of the shoe is quite short.
Yes.
It? So where the tongue comes up, we call that whole apron on the front coming up around the tongue, we call that the plug.
Mm.
And it's like quite short.
Yes.
So again, it gives lots of sock that you can see.
Exactly.
And a more kind of European loafer is like to come further up the front of your foot kind of thing.
Mm.
But that was obviously key to the style.
Yeah, I just felt like it really defined, especially for what we were doing with our own look, you know, giving that kind of sock and giving that whole area a little bit more of a kind of play around, that this type of shoe or this lower vamp would work. Mm. And when we started talking about it, I think, you know, instantly you were able to, I think I'd seen a shoe that you'd done, which was a a dress shoe or
it was like a
patent dress shoe, kind of thing. And I thought, my God, that's the like the silhouette of that was unbelievable, and it made me think of this of this sort of vintage part.
So that, I mean, that's an important thing to talk about, because when we talked about this particular shoe and that kind of very fine
sole,
very fine look to it, and that dress slipper that we've got has got a very fine sole, which can only be that fine because it's cemented on it. So it's a very thin piece of leather that's cemented onto the bottom of the shoe. But most of what we do in our factory is Goodyear welted, and that's like a two-layer. It's kind of like having two layers of leather. So you can't get it that thin.
No.
But when we went through and we made the shoe two different ways, you still went for the Goodyear welted, which was really interesting to me, because I thought you might go for the cemented, other way. But you wanted the proper... Because Goodyear welted, for people who don't know, is like the king of shoemaking. It's like the ultimate shoe.
And I think that's probably why. And I think I was very interested to test... You know, to learn about, it's new to me. I'm fascinated by it all. But coming up to the factory and meeting everybody, it really gave me a chance to understand the capabilities of what you could do with that shoe, or what a Goodyear welted shoe. You know, what goes into making it. And I think when I came down to it, I said, okay, well, look, if we can tweak the tolerances of how thick the sole is, let's say, we could achieve that.
And you pushed as hard.
I tried. I do. I push everyone hard, but I don't realize I actually do it. I just smile
in a really beautiful way. Yeah,
I try my best not to be too overbearing, but I do always like to know how far I can push something respectfully.
Yeah.
Just to see, well, hey, is that even possible, you know? And I really feel just amazed at how we what we created from it, you know, and just slimlining and profiling certain parts of it.
It was a lovely process.
I still think about coming up to the factory. I think it was great. And what I loved the most, well, one of the highlights was meeting all of the different people that made the shoes, you know, all the different sections you go to, from the person, the clicker who'd be cutting all the all the pieces, to then moving up to the skivers, is it, where they'd sort of take
skiving the edge.
And that was an amazing point, because
the closing room,
but that was an amazing point, because at that point I met them. They were talking about how we could get down like a strap that was going over the shoe to make it even more just a little bit more delicate, as opposed to being a bit more chunky, and without just saying hi and understanding what they did.
The type of leather we use in Goodyear Weld tends to be quite chunky, which is what makes them quite solid. Because that's the kind of best way to make a shoe for a long time. But what you wanted, just to explain to people, was the edge. You didn't want it to look too thick and too chunky.
Yeah.
So we skive it down and we basically shave off the very edge of it, so it comes down to a point.
To a point.
And looks a lot finer.
Yeah, just for those little finishing bits. And I was amazed to be able to just see that happen as we were like finishing up our sort of factory visit. They came up and, oh, there you go.
There you go.
And there was a guy who's a sort of old scooter boy, and that was beautiful that I got to meet
That's
him.
Right.
And I loved him. Me and him got
Brian,
on. Like, yeah, I'm still texting him.
Oh, yeah.
No, I'm joking. But I would if I could get his number.
But we had no idea that he was a mod, and he was
brilliant.
Scooter boy.
You know, he had his rings on, and he had his. I knew. I could spot.
I know, you
we
said
were skin
that.
Spirits. I could see. Yeah, beeline for him.
Yeah.
No, it was great. It was
fantastic. And how's the reaction been to the
brilliant.
Shoe so far?
Really great.
Has
I
it?
Mean, you know, naturally, you know, in the States, they love the idea of a British-made shoe. They love, you know, all that it is. And
they understand the Goodyear welted thing often more than an English customer does.
They seem to, you know, they seem to look for those marks and really interested by the idea of it, you know, being a Northampton-based company, knowing of Grenson's already, you know, some not, some, you know, just...
And some
just,
not.
Well, I know, how dare
how
they?
Dare
I shouldn't have said that. Edit that out. But they... But it's been great. It's been a really lovely, really lovely response, and just lovely to create and work with something new, you know, and shoot with something different. And
great.
Yeah, it's been a joy, a real joy.
Fantastic. Well, we've loved every minute of it. I've loved chatting to you today and hearing the story. And good luck with everything. Thank and I just advise much. Anybody listening to come and see, well, actually, sorry, to get an appointment.
That, no, they can come. We have open days every month, once a month, but I'm always there. So just
see your
on the
beautiful
door.
Collection and take a look at the shoe, even.
Yes, so, it will be.
Which is also available online, I guess, at Grenson and with
Scott
you,
so. Fraser Collection. Yeah. There you are.
Fantastic. Thank awesome. You very much,
My
Scott.
Pleasure,
Great
Tim.
To see
Thank
you.
Thank you so much.
As always, we'd love to hear your thoughts on the podcast. If you're enjoying it, hit the subscribe button and leave a review. Or if you have something to say, email us at thegrensonpodcast@grenson.co.uk.